Hello and welcome to the Heads and Volleys podcast with me, Lee Dunn.
Heads and Volleys, I have a very special guest today. My guest is Sina Azimi. He and I were on the C license, the old C license, the 8-day crash course in Texas in 2014, mate, 2014. Sina, how are you doing?
Good, man. Good to be with you, my friend.
I'm so happy to have you on here, and I'm excited to get into your analysis pieces, but give us a little intros to who you are, where you're from, kind of your coaching pathway.
Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me. Looking forward to our discussion. So I myself and my siblings, we basically moved to Canada in 2009, and I started coaching soccer at a very low level. And the more I did it, the more I realized that I'm quite passionate about working with the kids and teaching them about the game. And I started going through my coaching certifications. I started with what at the time was known as a provincial license coach. So for those in the States, it would be basically a license that you would get through your state organization and not the national organization like USSF. So I got that. And then I was looking at going through certification in different countries. And that's when I decided to do the national C license in the States. And that's where we basically met. I think that course was one of the, before I did my other licenses in Canada, the national C license really opened my eyes to the analysis piece of the game. Especially, I'm sure you remember the analysis that we had to do of an MLS game going to the course.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we did that, and that's when I realized I had a real passion for the analysis piece of the game of soccer. Then came back and did my national B license with the Canadian Soccer Association, which would be basically the equivalent of USSF national B license. Is through the national organization. And then I actually started coaching with my provincial level license with the high performance teams in one of the clubs in Toronto. So basically the high performance league would be what we refer to as Ontario Player Development League. So okay. Players practice 4 to 5 times a week, including a fitness session. And they have the opportunity to get scouted for the provincial team. And depending on how talented they are, they could also get invitations for the Rex program, which is basically the camp that prepares you to join the national team.
Okay, so that would be similar to teams or players making state teams here and then going on in effectively the ODP program or the PDP program and then making that into youth national camps and so on. It's like a pyramid, so it's very similar.
Yeah, yeah.
So why get into soccer when you first got into Canada? What was it about soccer? You grew up playing, you kind of, that was your way into the community. Why soccer?
Yeah. So before we even moved to Canada, I played soccer since the very young age. And when we moved to Canada and when I started going to high school, I think soccer was something that helped me basically connect with a whole different type of population that I wasn't used to. And before you know it, after a week in high school, I had many friends that I did not anticipate of having. And then I played the game. I enjoyed the game, but I wasn't really a high level player. So I never played the game at a high level, but I had this tendency to go back to the game and try to break the game down and study the game inside out. And, that's when basically when I started working with my mentor coach in the club that I'm working with. We've been working together for what, close to 10, 11 years now. And he basically realized that, okay, I can see something during the games that he may not see because he's busy coaching our own team, whereas I'm busy looking at the opponent and how we could break them down based on a discussion that we could have with the players at halftime. So that's basically, if I'm not a head coach on the bench per se, and I'm his assistant coach, then my role is to analyze the opponent, look at their weaknesses and their strengths, and see how we could capitalize on their weaknesses. So long story short, I wasn't really a good soccer player, but I was really good at breaking the opponent down.
Which, so you touched on a couple of really good points there too about the idea of being an assistant. And sometimes people may take an assistant role as a bad role or something they don't want to do. No one really wants to be an assistant per se. Everyone wants the limelight of being the head coach. And so really taking that and maximizing that for your own development. And to go back to what you said about the C license, where we were given a random game and we watched it over and over and over again. And even once we had submitted the assignment, we still got some marks back saying, what about this or what about that? And then started watching it again and again. And you know, like, I remember there was commentary on it. I just remember even I could probably recite the commentary because we watched it that much. Yeah. And that, like you said, is probably the first kind of foray into analysis for most people. I know for me, it really was my first look at actually breaking the game down analytically and beginning to look at it in a way that wasn't just the ball going in the goal or a nice moment of the game. So what is it about, kind of, was that you taking on that role with the, as an assistant, kind of deciding that I'm going to maximize this role and to kind of take advantage? I know you said that kind of analysis had been something that you've been interested in for a while. Is that something that you just took on and said, this is what I'm going to do?
Good question. I think when I started working with my mentor coach, he had a time, he had an assistant coach before I even joined the group of coaching that he had. And we started working with a group of very talented, super talented, under 14 boys. And we had them basically until they got their full ride scholarship to many universities in the States. And, he asked me to be on the bench with him and the other assistant coach. And I kept just watching the game as the game was going on. And I would just give him a few suggestions here and there. And I think one thing that's very important, especially for young assistant coaches, is to be okay to when they get rejected. So for instance, myself and the head coach, I would give him a lot of suggestions and he would say, no, 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 no. But the one point that he would say yes to, that will really make the difference. So just being open-minded and not knowing that not everything that you say is going to be accepted, and that's fine, because first of all, the head coach has many more years of coaching experience than you. So he might be evaluating your decision and say, okay, no, that's not the right decision. But the one point that you make could really make the big difference.
Now, do you ever go back and reflect on that? So if you said, for example, there's a weakness on the left side and the coach decides not to make any sort of change to exploit that, do you ever have a conversation afterwards about that? So it's something that you might learn too, or something that you can say, okay, I understand why, or is that just kind of a heat at the moment where we're not going to do that?
If I don't get the answer by the end of the game, then I ask that question, yeah. Or sometimes I just straight up say, we should have done that. That would have made a difference. And sometimes, yeah, it's the head coach saying, yeah, sorry, I made a mistake. And then next time that we come across the same situation, then we know, okay, last time we either made the mistake or we did the right thing. So either let's do the same thing or let's change it. But yeah, I try to walk away with a clear mind and not have questions. And I think that's the beauty of having an open relationship between assistant coaches and head coaches, and a relationship that is not egocentric, is not based on ego, is based on learning. Yeah.
That's really cool. I like that, to be able to bring that question up and then to actually have an answer, because that may be something that you might think about too, or certain players in certain moments. So that leads me into the idea of, then being a head coach on a field, are you still looking at the opponent? How do you set up a game if it's just you, you've got no assistant? How do you approach that game with knowing how important it is to read the game and read the opponent, but then also knowing what's going on with your own team too?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's basically, I coach an under 12 team now, and some of the under 12 teams are tactically very sound because they've got good head coaches who have gone through their coaching certification. So if it's just myself with on the bench, if I know it's going to be just me on the bench on a weekend, then I try to prepare the team as best as I can. So when it gets to the game day, I have to focus less on my own team and focus more on the opponent. And the other thing that I try to do, and I think this just goes for head coaches, young head coaches, or young assistant coaches, is I try to look away from the ball when I coach. Doesn't matter if I'm the head coach or the assistant coach sitting on the bench. If the ball is in, let's say, the final third, my eyes are probably in the defensive third to make sure that the team is tactically sound in case we give up the ball. So, and that's not something easy that I had to learn. It takes a lot of practice, but once you learn it and once you make a habit of it, it makes a huge difference.
I think you can even see that from the coach who we always kind of call it like joystick coaching, but they're the ones who are clearly watching the ball because they're talking through every moment that we should have passed there, we should have kicked there. But if you're really looking away from the ball and looking at other aspects of the game, you don't really notice the small little things that a lot of coaches will actually tend to coach about.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that I learned just working as an assistant coach in the early years of my coaching, working with my mentor coach. He was the head coach, and let's say the ball was in the final third, and I would hear him call the name of the fullback who was in almost like the defensive, almost in the center of the park. And it would just shock me. I'm like, why is he looking at the fullback? The other team's 18-yard box. So we just had those conversations, and he said, no, you have to start coaching away from the ball. And then he would come and see me coach as a head coach, and he would just mention it to me straight up. Hey, your coach, he would basically use the same word that you use, your joystick in the game. I'm like, how do you not do that? He's like, stop looking at the ball.
Interesting, yeah.
Not something easy, but once you learn it, it makes a huge difference.
So do you find that that's made a difference in your game approach, your game coaching, for actually paying attention to the nuances away from the ball?
Oh yeah, 100%. And I think the more I do it, the more I realize that I'm often one step ahead of the other coach. So I'm, I guess, quote unquote, out coaching the other coach by being ahead of him. Mm-hmm. If he is the type of coach who's coaching on the ball. So yeah. if I'm the one who's coaching off the ball, then I can react way faster, and my players can react way faster than the other team's reacting.
So as soon as the game kicks off and the coach is immediately jumping on moments of the game where his team has the ball, do you kind of rub your hands together like, here we go, this is going to be a good one?
Oh, yeah. And I have I have this routine that I don't coach. I try not to coach in the first 10 minutes of the game. I just want to see how the game's going. I'm evaluating the other coach. Is he losing his mind? And if he's losing his mind, then I'm not going to lose my mind. So I'm going to get the best of it. And I just watch. I watch the opponent. I see what formations they're playing. How are they high pressing? Are they staying in the mid block? And how my players are reacting to whatever situation's coming up.
Do you use your substitutes? So I know, like, for example, with the younger players, or actually, to be honest, with most players, if they're a sub, then they may give them tasks, and it's probably more about engaging them and not having them messing around on the sideline because they think that when they're not in the game, they're not part of the game. So do you use your substitutes for that sort of stuff, or do they have like a task on the bench, or are they just informed to watch the game?
Very good question. With mostly all of our high performance teams, every player who's on the bench as a substitute has a task of either tracking the number of completed passes, tracking the number of tackles made, tracking the number of second balls that we are winning or losing, tracking the number of shots we've conceded or shots we've made on target. So every player in our high performance stream has a task if they're sitting on the bench, and it just forces them to be so engaged with the game. On the youth level, I try to put them in groups of two or three because obviously they might not be as fast when it comes to recording number of passes. Or I try to tell the younger players. So for instance, I give them a heads up. I say, okay, you're on to go in 10 minutes. So you're going to go and play on the outside left. make sure you watch the other team's outside back on the right side, because that's the person that you're going to attack. And if he or she has questions before going on, then like they might come and say, okay, the other team's outside back on the right side is left-footed or right-footed. Should I force them this way and that way? So they wouldn't have that question if they weren't watching.
Yeah, yeah. That's so true, because a lot of time, especially some younger kids will be asking, can I go in, coach? Can I go in, coach? Can I go in, coach? Can I go in, play? And if you, I attribute that to my training environment, in that I'll try and give them the practice plan and the idea of the practice ahead of time. So they have a clue, they have some answers, and that's just the same thing in a game situation. Now, I'll say that it probably takes, it's a skill to have that organization during a game, because there's a lot of things that are going on, especially if you imagine yourself as that coach who's screaming and yelling from the initial kickoff. Your players probably don't get that sort of support from you.
No, no. And I think that it's important for the players to realize how much it would benefit them if they end up actually watching the game instead of just asking questions about, okay, coach, can I go on? Can I go on? It would just make the game so much more simple for them. The piece about not yelling, I think if you are a coach who yells on the sideline and you want to be a better coach, you just have to stop doing it. I'm not saying don't yell and motivate your players. There's nothing wrong with saying, let's go, guys. Good job. Good work. Proud of you. Blah, blah, blah. But yelling to coach the game, I think if the coaches at the highest level are not doing it, then why are we doing it?
True.
Even now, because there are no fans in stadiums, if you watch the Premier League, if you watch any Premier League coaches, you see, for instance, Klopp was up 1-0 yesterday in the game against Arsenal, and he ended up losing the game 2-1 because of two silly mistakes by his world-class center back and his world-class goalkeeper. And if you saw him, he was just sitting on his seat. He wasn't yelling. So if the coaches at the highest level are not doing it, there is no reason for us to do it.
I completely agree. I've often had people, or I've had parents say that, coach, we don't think that you're as into it because you don't yell like the other team's coach was. Or the idea that you hear parents, and especially true during tournaments too, where there's lots of games going on, I always try and observe other coaches, and the parents are like, oh, he's so good. Look how much he's yelling at them. He really wants us to do well here. He really wants us to do this or that. But my understanding from my conversation with players is that they don't listen to that anyway. And surely that's just ruining your own psyche by winding yourself up with shouting.
Yeah. And if you look at the literature from child psychology, and I don't think you know that. I'm not sure if you know this. I got a year and a half left in my PhD at the University of Toronto. So where I focus on research about youth athlete development and the relationship between parents, coaches, and the athletes in the youth sport environment. There is a ton of research out there, previously published research, that have qualitative research where the researchers have conducted interviews with youth athletes, and they tell us, we don't like the yelling, especially from the parents. We don't like the yelling from the coaches, because the more yelling, the more confused we are throughout the game. So if you've got something to tell us, just either pull us off the field and tell us, or just wait till halftime.
So the data's there. The logic is not, I guess, a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So then when you're watching a game, when you're analyzing in the middle of a game, you're assessing the opponent, you're assessing kind of away from the ball. Do you have specifics that you look for, or are you kind of looking with an open mind and beginning to look at potential avenues for success? So are you looking at strengths of your team against their weaknesses, or are you looking for certain things that you could exploit with some changes? Kind of how do you set up for like using your analysis for success during the throw of a game?
Mm-hmm. I think based on the way that we play in the club that I coach, we're a very possession-based team with a great degree of emphasis on width and depth of the field when we're in possession, and also the intensity of high pressing when we're counter pressing when we're off, we're out of possession. So I think the moment the game starts, if I'm watching our own team, I'm looking at, okay, are the players as wide as they could be when we're in the buildup? If we're in the buildup phase, is our number six, sorry, number six is a holding mid in the US system, right?
Yes.
Is our number six being mobile? Is she looking, is she checking her shoulder? Is she perceiving the space, the teammates, the ball? And are we going to be successful in the buildup phase? And I guess in the out of possession phase of the game, looking at how the intensity of the press, whether the press is triggered by the right person and or the player, and whether or not the other players are following with the same intensity. Are we blocking every single option? And if it's getting towards the end of the game where we might not have the legs to for high pressing, then are we as compact as we could be? And are we preventing every central penetration? And if we have to push them to the outside, then we could deal with that after. But yeah, so I guess a lot of my analysis throughout the game goes back to the way we play, our philosophy behind the way we play, and making sure that the opponent cannot capitalize on the potential weaknesses that we might have.
And so you talk about having an understanding of what the team does. So you talk about like the way the team plays, the philosophy behind it. And I always hear coaches say that games are for the players. That's where players have their fun, if you like. That's where players can go and show what they know. And so the training environment is clearly connected for success in a game. Do you, when you're working with your players, like you said, you kind of set yourself up for the coming weekend, knowing what the situation is going to be. And so do you have an expectation of the teams that you play against, you kind of get when you play against clubs? Because I have the same experience here where we play against a certain club, we know roughly what they're going to try and do. And commonly actually in the US, especially here in the Bay Area, most people play a 4-3-3. So we kind of have a general understanding of what we're going to face anyway. Do you find yourself knowing that sort of information too, and being able to have like standards for your team that you're always looking for, like you said about width and depth? So you know you're always going to kind of have an advantage over an opponent anyway.
Yeah. So in the first year of OPDL, I believe it's mandatory for every team to play 4-3-3. So we play 4-3-3. It might be with a 6 and an 8 sitting beside each other, or 6 being 4-3-3 with number 6 alone and 8 and 10 sitting beside each other. Mm-hmm. So I think one way that we look to see if we could penetrate through the same formation, 4-3-3, based on different systems of play, is to ask our players to be mobile and a lot of just being patient, especially in the build-up phase. But as we get closer to the attacking third or the opponent's defensive third, can our players be mobile enough to cause enough confusion for the other team? Because at the end of the day, everyone's playing 4-3-3. So I think it's just being adaptable enough to come up with different systems of play. And I think something that I'm always trying to remind young coaches is to not confuse a formation with a system of play. That's just a pet peeve of mine. They are not the same thing.
So give us a difference explanation.
The difference between the two?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you could... A formation is basically how your team is going to organize in either the defensive phase or the attacking phase. So a team could be 4-3-3 in attack, but the system of play is how are you going to execute that 4-3-3 formation? Are you going to execute it with one holding? Are you going to execute it with two holding? Are you going to have your number 8 and number 10 entering the half spaces, or do you want them more central? Those are systems of play, which often is not mentioned. It's mostly formations. And also each team, I believe, my personal opinion, each team should have a defensive formation and an attacking formation, or in possession formation and out of possession formation, depending on where they are on the field. You can't play a 3-5-2, both in attack and defense, or you may, depending on the system of play that you want to execute.
So do you think that playing within the league that you do where it's mandated for a 4-3-3 is restrictive, or do you think that there's enough kind of variation and flexibility within that formation to have your style of play that can be expressive whilst I'm assuming still looking like a 4-3-3 to the people that care about it being a 4-3-3?
I think so. It's mandatory for first year of OPDL, which is basically the first year where players turn from under 12-9v9 to under 13-11v11. So I think it's a good decision to have it mandatory because it makes it easier for players to transition from 9v9 to 11v11. It would be different for a 13-year-old coming out of 12-year-old, a U13 player coming out of 9v9 to say, okay, we're going to play a 4-2-3-1. That's going to be much more difficult for them. But I think depending on the knowledge of the coaches and how their degree of, I think, imagination, which I think is very important for any coach, you have to be very good at imagining different pictures. You could still execute different types of 4-3-3. You could start your build-up with back four, and depending on the opponent, you could transition to a back three, just like Liverpool, by pushing your right fullback up the pitch, and you build up with three. So you could still be in the 4-3-3, and your build-up phase could be your number six dropping in between your number four and five, and two and the three go up, and now you have a back three and a midfield four. And next thing you know, your 4-3-3 looks like a 3-4-3.
Right.
Still in a 4-3-3, again, different systems of play. And I must say, how good you can execute a system of play 100% depends on the characteristics of your players. You cannot say, I want to play a possession-based game if you don't have the players who could play possession-based game soccer. Or you have to teach them from the very young age. And you see at the highest level of the game, Pep Guardiola went from Barcelona B to Barcelona A, and he was successful because he had a lot of players who came up with the same philosophy throughout the academy. When he tried to do the same thing at Manchester City in his first year, he basically failed. He went out and he spent millions of dollars or pound for euros for players who could play that system of play that he wants to play. And if you listen to any interview that he does, he always talks about the characteristics of the players being the driven factor for the systems of play that he wants to execute. Or even with Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool. Liverpool might not be as technical as Manchester City, but they are one of the hardest working teams when it comes to counter-pressing. So you want, if that's the system of play that you want to play, you want players like Mane, Salah, Firmino to be hardworking, absolute engines that could just press continuously.
And it's interesting too how you said about having the idea or having the creativity as a coach. And I've seen screenshots of the way Man City build, and they build in so many different variations with centre-backs pushing higher up the field and then the centre midfielder dropping in inside the box to receive the ball from a goalkeeper. And I see a lot of build out is very robotic. It's very like, this is how we do it. The fullbacks push higher and the six drops in between the four and the five. And so I think if you're going to play that way, you might as well use the players that have the skills. And often in a 4-3-3, I think probably a six is one of the key players and probably one of your better players too. So why not get them on the ball as quick as possible? And I think maybe there's an element of, this is the way you do it. The centre-back split and the full-backs go higher. This is how you do it. I mean, even on my A license, talking about field sessions and coaches, pretty much every coach describing the build-out being in the same way. And I think a lot of the time you can actually have some fun with it as a coach, perhaps, to be creative and challenge your players in a different way.
And the importance of being creative with coming up with different plans is to make sure that you have enough solutions if the opponent is smart enough to block one of your platforms. So if one platform is to have your right fullback go up the pitch and you have the, instead of the back four, you build up with the back three, what if they block that? So what if that platform doesn't work out? Do you have a plan B, or do you have a different platform where you could drop your number six in between your center backs. And players have to be able, they must have done this in practice before they get to the game. We cannot be teaching this at halftime.
Do you film your games? Do you analyze after the fact? And then any analysis that you do you then share that with them? Or to what depth do you share your analysis with your players kind of post-game?
Yeah, so our games in OPDL, they're all video recorded. And if I do end up watching game for the sake of analysis, the overall analysis, I don't share with the players if I'm not the head coach. Because I don't want to say something that it might not be what the head coach wants to translate to the players. So the overall story of tactics is told to the head coach by myself. So, or whereas if I see specific things that each individual player is not doing and they should be doing, then I just show it to them myself. Mm-hmm. There's no need of just taking the time of the head coach to say, okay, can you show this to this player? And I have the tendency to gravitate towards the midfield three, especially in the 4-3-3. I just enjoy watching how they move in the game, or whether they're just how good their decision making is, how good is their ability to find space. So when I watch our own games, I usually look at the quality of the number six, her decision making, the quality of number eight, and their decision making in relation to number six, and can they be mobile when it comes to rotations?
So do you have a personal preference then on perhaps using professional analysis too, the teams that you follow? I noticed that you use Pep and Man City a lot. There's often Liverpool. Is that because those speak to the way you like to play as well? Or is that partly just because maybe that's the most common thing that people are seeing right now?
I've always been a fan of Guardiola since his early years in Barcelona. And I think what makes him, I guess, unique and different than any other coach, I'm not saying other coaches are not as good as him. I think it's his ability to be so clear with his teams when it comes to his philosophy and the way he wants to play. I think there are many teams, Premier League, in Bundesliga, in other Italian or the Italian league, where you watch them many times and you're not still able to identify the identity of the team. Whereas with Manchester City, you could watch two games and you could describe their philosophy in five sentences. Especially with Liverpool, you could describe their philosophy. But I think it's important, and I've been trying to remind myself to not just watch teams like Manchester City or possession-based teams. I watch teams that park a 4-4-2 and they sit for 85 minutes or 80 minutes and they are very effective at counterattacking. So I think for young coaches out there, or even any coaches, it's important to be flexible, different systems of play. So if one way doesn't work out, or if you are a possession-based team and you end up against a very good team and you're winning the game, okay, are you able to tell your team, we're going to sit deep, we're going to sit in a low block, absorb pressure, and engage in a counterattack, if the characteristics of the players allow you to do that? I think I'm a big fan of Guardiola. That's a I'll be the first person to say it. I think I enjoy how he's evolved as a coach and how he's evolved the whole idea of the game that he plays. If you look at, there's a great analysis video on YouTube that I watched the other day, and it talks about the evolution of Pep Guardiola in Barcelona, Bayern Munich, and in Manchester City. And you could tell his philosophy is absolutely clear. It doesn't change. But the system of play, the way he executes that philosophy, is a little bit different based on the characteristics of his players. You could not do what he did with Ribery and Robin in Bayern with David Villa and I think Thierry Henry at a time in Barcelona.
Right. So then does that... I just love the... the awareness and, like you said, understanding and acknowledging that there are other formations, there are other systems of play. So you talk about how infatuated you can be with the way the midfield works, midfield rotation, or the way there's certain characteristics of players playing in those roles. Do you then, the idea of looking at other ways of playing, you're taking away kind of ideas, do you share those with the players that play in those roles? So for example, you have a number six who plays for you, and that number six could probably benefit from seeing clips of Busquets because he plays in a similar way, and that's something that you will use. So do you watch with the intent of sharing that with players as well, especially if they're your players and you're not necessarily the assistant coach? Do you use that also?
Absolutely. There's been a number of times where I either sent them videos of the likes of Iniesta or Xavi or the likes of Busquets and telling them, okay, can watch this video and count the number of times Xavi checks his shoulder. Or often we see players, especially in midfield area, especially with the number six, being so constrained to the central channel. And when you watch Liverpool, sometimes they use a platform for their build-up where the number six basically becomes their right back, and the whole right side of the team gets expanded towards the opponent's net. So I think it just enhances their imagination by saying, hey, okay, you're in the middle of the park, but you don't really have to stay here, depending on where the ball is and depending on the opponent. If the opponent is sitting in low block and we want to occupy every single channel across the field, exterior channels, interior channel, and central channel, you don't necessarily have to be in the central channel if there's someone else. And I think that's something that I learned from watching Liverpool, watching Man City, watching, I think I watched Bayern, and there was another team in the Bundesliga. Bundesliga, I think, is one of the best leagues for watching and analyzing the league in terms of the tactical components.
I think the restart has been really good, even from my level, where I feel like there you can see clear nuances in teams, and maybe because they were slow to get back at it, but teams have an identity for the most part, and you can see that more defensive teams, the teams that will sit back and play almost counter to what their opponent is playing. I think it becomes really clear when they've just got back in. It's almost like preseason games. So I think that's been really helpful for me. Just it's almost like it's been in slow motion. Mm-hmm. And so your Twitter is at analysis by Cena. And so is that platform for you? And I recommend anybody get on there and check it out, because the stuff on there is, at times it seems simple, but it's so obvious and it's so significant in the moment of the game that you're showing. Now, is that a hobby for you? Is that something that you're using to continue to develop yourself? Is that something that you are using with your own players too? Or is it kind of, why do you use it that way? Why do you put it out?
Depending on the level of analysis that I'm doing, then that determines whether I'm sharing it with the players or not. If for instance, I believe last year we started teaching the concepts of five channels across the field. So I wouldn't share that level of analysis with the players if they were not familiar with it. But the analysis that I've done on the central midfielders, that definitely gets shared with the midfielders 100%. The analysis that I've done on some teams' set pieces, I think that's helpful for the players and the coaching staff to see. But yeah, it's been a hobby of mine. I just enjoyed the conversation about analysis, and also one of the driving factor behind it was to share this conversation with others and the other people, the other individuals on Twitter who do great work for analysis, just to comment and say, hey, just what you just posted doesn't make sense. And it's good to see a good, just be open-minded and say, oh yeah, it doesn't make sense, I don't know why I posted that. But it just creates good conversation. And I think the beauty of this game is that it could be played in so many different ways. It's not to say that Lee's way is better than Cena's way or vice versa. I think the coaches have to be open-minded towards the fact that this game is a team game and every coach could have their own influences on the team. And I think one thing that doesn't change is the characteristics of the players should be the driving factor for whatever system of play you decide to play. But one system of play is not better than the other one. I think the game of soccer is flexible enough that you could play multiple systems of play, and you can't really necessarily say one is better than the others.
And do you take that analysis? You feel like every time you're doing it, it's just increasing your knowledge, it's increasing your understanding, is increasing. And I guess this is something that I believe in. And when I see some of the stuff you share, it, for me, sometimes it's just simple realizations. And I really appreciate the connection that teams may show their players or coaches may show their players a phase of buildup from Man City. But if their players aren't familiar with kind of the concept and the why and certain movements, or even like you said about the five channels, then the players don't understand that. And it's kind of a moot point. So what does your training environment look like in terms of developing that? So you're then sharing the idea of five channels on the field. What does that look like in your training environment? Is that simply setting up games and creating those channels and explaining how you want to use them and why you would use them? Or do you do it in other ways?
No, very good question. We make sure there's consistency between what we tell the players in terms of analysis and also the environment that we create for teaching them. So for instance, a rule of thumb, I think not just for our club, but for anyone playing a 4-3-3 or any system of play with three midfielders, is to not have the three midfielders in the same channel and the same height. So basically, you don't want a flat midfield three, or you don't want a midfield three in a triangle shape where your 8 and 10 are occupying the same height, because basically one defender could take both of them out of the game. So we just create different exercises where we could just create channels of. Or for instance, the one we do with the midfielders is a box with nine, a box where it has three vertical and three horizontal channels. So if you just imagine it, it would be a big square with nine tiny squares in it. And we put players on the outside of the box and we put the midfield three in the box. And we just tell the midfield three, okay, every time you're going from one side of the box to the opposite side, you're not allowed to be in the same channel and the same height. And we just basically take that box that we created and we put it in the middle of the game. And when we're in the game, during halftime, we say, okay, sometimes we're coming flat, make sure we're not same channel, same height, they know exactly what we're preparing to.
So you have constant reference. This is what we did in practice. This is what we're expecting in the game. And now we can have a conversation about it in the heat of the moment when it needs to be had.
Yeah, yeah.
Simple, huh? Seems so simple.
Simple.
So as we wrap up, let me ask you about tactical understandings for players. Are there some things that you think all players should know, some players should learn? Are there kind of things that you think players should learn as they grow? You're talking 6, 7, 8, 9 year olds that are starting to play the game, and I see some footage online, and I interviewed John Kokoris from Johan Juniors, and he's got his kids playing incredible soccer. And then there will be other coaches who say, kids can't do that. And yet there's some proof there. So, and then there's the argument always of technical versus tactical. And I think that's an overdone argument too. And it's kind of silly, I think, actually. But do you have some consistency that you have maybe within the club that you've learned, or something that you've implemented for yourself that you think all players should have an understanding of at each age or at each level of play?
Yeah, I think... And this is something that's often overlooked, but I believe it's something that it's common for any player of any age that they have to learn, and that's their decision making and their perception off the ball. I think coaches should try to teach players to perceive the field, and often when you talk about perception, the player should be looking for four things: the ball, the teammate, the opponent, and the space. Sorry, in order, the space, teammate, opponent, and ball. Players should be looking at the ball as the last thing. So, and trust me, it gets much harder to teach as players get older because they haven't made the habit. And so for 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, if they could learn to perceive and look off the ball, it's going to make their decision-making better, which then is going to reduce the number of errors they make in the game. It's going to increase the rate of pass completion and so on. And it, you could create some many simple exercises for players of different ages to learn to perceive. You could give them, you could have a passing and receiving exercise where the two coaches on two opposite ends are holding different color pennies. And every time a player receives the ball, before they receive it, they have to call out the color. And then you could take that same exercise and as the game, and you could put the players in a 5v5 or a 7v7 small sided game, and the coach could just be on the outside. And instead of coaching the game, just put pennies up and see if they're calling the game, calling the color of the penny. I think perception, and I think that's what makes the difference between high-level academies like Barcelona. I can't remember the – I watched an interview where the director of academy was saying that in Barcelona, we don't teach players to pass. We teach them to perceive, whereas in many academies, I guess in North America, the first thing we teach the players at 6, 7, 8 years of age is to pass the ball. Mm-hmm. So why pass the ball if they don't know where to pass it and they don't know how to perceive the space to pass it into? So regardless of the age, perception, which then plays into decision-making, I think is something that should be taught at any level. And it gets harder the older the players get because it's not a habit.
So when we've got them at such a young age and they're so pliable, we can look at getting them into these good habits early on, like you say, the idea of the perception.
Yeah, and it, even just what showing if the players get older, like 10, 11, 12 years of age, if you watch, just watching videos of Xavi or Kevin De Bruyne, and now one of the best midfielders in the game, if you just watch how many times he perceives the space before he receives the ball, it's amazing. And I think they asked Xavi of Barcelona, and they said, okay, what is it that hurts the most after a game? And he said, my neck, because he keeps looking so often.
Imagine that. Coach, my neck hurts from consistently looking around. I don't think I've never hear that. That'd be a nice thing to hear.
Oh, absolutely.
So then, based on after every tournament, and it's been a shame that we haven't had the Euros this year. So do you think that after every tournament, there tends to be analysis and there was a trend in the tournament. There was a back three that was kind of commonplace or a certain style of build out or attack. Do you think, or what do you think is going to come? What do you think things are changing in a way that of course it's been like a possession. Most teams will say they are focused on possession for the most part. It's almost like saying, you know, we go long is like swearing nowadays when you talk about a coaching style or a system of play. So do you think that's going to evolve? Do you think that will be around for a long time? Or do you think the new stuff coming out, what do you think the game's going to look like in 5 years even?
I think, so again, I'll go back to what I said before, the whole possession versus non-possession or tiki-taka or long balls. We can't necessarily say one is better than the other, but I think a few years back, we saw the whole concept of possession-based soccer coming in by Pep Guardiola, and even before that with Johan Cruyff. But I think in 5 years from now, the game's going to be more fluid. You're going to see lots of more rotations on the field between players. Part of me thinks we're not going to be referring to players as a holding midfielder, attacking midfielders, or fullbacks. We're just going to refer to them as soccer players. And the whole numbering system, I think we could use the whole numbering system of a fullback being a 2 and a 3 or 6, 8, and 10 in the middle of the park. Those numbers referring to space and not players. I think the whole rotation of seeing Kyle Walker of Man City coming so far inside, where we would be teaching the fullbacks to be outside. He's coming inside to occupy space for a reason that he's been told by his manager. So I think the future of the game would be lots of more rotations between players, using the numbering system perhaps to refer to spaces instead of players, and also to prepare for that, preparing players that could play in all positions. Creating global players and not just a defender. not just a holding midfielder. Can the holding midfielder play as a center back, and when needed, can play as an attacking midfielder? I think the whole concept of attacking, holding midfielder is going to go away. Fullbacks, they're just going to be, thinking about it, they would just be referred to as soccer players.
So you make a really interesting point. And if you think about even watching Man City play and when De Bruyne plays, De Bruyne is De Bruyne. He does what he does. So there's times where he splits the center backs. There's times where he's on the edge of the box scoring. And that you can't give that a number. So I agree with you that you can't say he's a central midfielder, because he's clearly not in most of those instances. He is De Bruyne. And even if I think about the players I coach, how they become so pigeonholed into, I am a number two, I'm a number three, I'm a number six. And even with them, as they grow, I'm trying to create the idea of like relatable positions. So a six should be able to play center back, a six should be able to play attacking midfield, or at least have an understanding and be able to move between those positions much more freely. So I like how you say that it's going to become much more fluid. And I think if we're really thinking about how to make an impact on a game, you need a player at any moment to have a moment of magic. And I think sometimes if a player is pigeonholed into a right back, and I think even to the lowest level where defenders are told that they're a defender and they don't cross the halfway line. I talked to my wife about her growing up playing soccer in the US, and she said, as a defender, we stood on the halfway line, and if the ball came, we kicked it, and then we didn't go anywhere further beyond that. And I still see that in the youth beginning game right now. So I think the idea of starting with such a younger age and really encouraging them to play in all positions but have the fluidity is something that I think is going to take a lot of work, but I completely agree with you.
And also, yeah, the coaches have to be able to educate the players and the parents, because often asking an attacking midfielder or a striker to play as a fullback, it's not going to be a good conversation with the parents. So just educating them on what the benefits are. I think just beside the whole soccer part of it, for players who want to play at the next level, the next level being the provincial or the state team or playing for the national team or getting full ride scholarships, if you're a player who's just going to play one position and you walk into a squad of 20 players and the coach says, I have enough fullbacks, what else can you give me? And you say, well, nothing.
Then you fall back, yeah.
Your chance of getting a full ride scholarship is so minimal compared to someone who can provide the coach with two or three options. Because at the end of the day, coaches love having options.
And then the flexibility, like you said, if the game's going to become more fluid and more flexible, you want to be able to pull on any player and ask them to be able to fulfill a role in a certain moment. And I think even if I look around sometimes at the bench and I look at players who are very pigeonholed, it's a disservice to themselves almost.
Yeah. And you see at the highest level of the game, you see, for instance, when Kevin De Bruyne comes and plays as a holding mid, someone else somewhere is occupying the space that he just left. It's never that he would leave his own space where he's assigned to, quote unquote, and there is no one occupying the space. You never see two players occupying the same space, at least in the highest level of the game. And even if we've seen Kyle Walker play as a fullback, center back, something, he comes in as a central midfielder to counter the counterattack. So just being able to think about those spaces and what is required of you as a player, depending on where you play, depending on which space you play in.
And so your analysis, to wrap it all up, helps you as a coach and as a student of the game see those ideas and to at least challenge your own thoughts around the way the game is played. And when you see a non-traditional action like Kyle Walker standing in the center of the park and the ball's not near him, but he's standing in there, most coaches might lose their mind. But if you look at it and begin to question kind of why that's happening and see the game as a bigger picture, you as a coach are going to understand a little bit more, at least have your beliefs challenged. And then that's something that you can pass on to your players, and your understanding of the game increases, your knowledge increases, and just the quality of the game continues to develop around you. So I think that is a real good takeaway. Now, as I said, your Twitter is Analysis by Cena. Do you have anything else we want to wrap up on here as we say adios?
No, I think it was a great discussion. I think the last thing I was going to say was to just be careful with adopting a new idea. For instance, when the whole inverted fullback idea came to play, a lot of coaches said, oh, we're going to invert our fullbacks. Okay, but why, first of all? Second of all, is your player capable of doing it? So, for instance, I did the analysis on set pieces. I believe it was Man City or Liverpool, where they had all the big guys up there in the 18 for an attacking corner kick, and they had two fullbacks just sitting on top of the 18. The two fullbacks were the two fastest players on the field. So if there was a chance of getting counterattack, then Kyle Walker could counter the counterattack. That was the reason behind it. So I think understanding the reason behind it, and also knowing that every system of play has certain strengths and certain weaknesses. Even Guardiola's Manchester City has weaknesses. Liverpool has certain weaknesses, as we saw against Arsenal. So just knowing the strengths and weaknesses of your system of play and ways to capitalize, to increase those strengths and minimize the weaknesses, then I think should be one of the focuses of the coaches.
See, now that's awesome. Thank you, mate. I really appreciate that. And I encourage everybody to follow you, to keep up with what you're doing in terms of the analysis and just challenge themselves. Like you said, it's always the idea of why. Why are we doing that? Why do we suddenly decide that we're going to do inverted fullbacks or we're going to do a false nine? Why? Have an understanding. So, Tino, thank you so much, mate. This is awesome.
No problem. It was a pleasure to be with you.
So usually when I wrap up a podcast, I would like to thank the person, of course. They donate their time to help you to share their message. And I think it's a really valuable experience that a podcast can provide. But I'm also super thankful selfishly because I took away so many moments from this conversation with Cena. And he and I have been friends for a long time now based on our experiences together from the C license back in the day, as we like to say. But really kind of picking his brain that's going to benefit myself. And kind of that's the foundation of what this podcast was really all about in terms of finding people to talk to that could help educate me, but then also pass on the important message that I think you should know too. And just looking back on the conversation with Cena and considering the way he watches a game and understanding a role as an assistant and actually probably embracing the assistant role more than many coaches might do. And I know many people will use an assistant role as a step to get into a head coach role or to get into another school or another club and be able to say that they've had that assistant coach experience, but really using that in the way that he mentioned in terms of providing analysis or providing guidance for the coach during the game. And I think that's something that I myself is a level that I have skipped and have always just gone straight into head coach roles and never really worked with assistants unless they've been younger. So I think it's a really interesting perspective and one that I think is super important, one that I think we should all really embrace. And just having an understanding and an idea for how you think the game should be played and why. We talk about why a lot in this episode and why are we doing it like this? Why are we doing it like that? And even just based on the kind of final takeaway of the consistency is key. Consistency in the messaging from training into games and not even changing things at halftime because of a panic when you consider the level of play that you're coaching. So a huge thank you to Cena. Make sure you check in with him at Analysis by Cena. Sina on Twitter. He's brilliant. I love seeing it a lot. So I just want to thank him so much for his time and thank you for listening. Please share. Please leave me a voicemail if you're interested. I'd love to know what you think and leave me a review on Apple. I really appreciate that, or anywhere else that you listen to your podcasts.